Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. This is an open forum. And we'll be lining up your phone calls here at 614-292-8513 to talk about local, national, and international issues. As I mentioned, Mayor Michael Coleman will be joining us to talk about the city of Columbus in the second hour of the show. Well, as you know, this is the fifth anniversary week of the beginning of the Iraq War, and a lot of talk about that, a lot of opinion. President Bush declared yesterday that the United States is on the cusp of victory in this five-year-old war in Iraq. He argued that the recent troop buildup has reduced violence there and, in his words, opened the door to a major strategic victory in the war on terror. Very optimistic remarks from the president. And he said, we did do the right thing in deposing Saddam Hussein through an invasion of Iraq. I wonder what you're thinking today. We're at 614-292-8513. If you look at public opinion polls, a good place to find them summarized on the web is called pollingreport.com. And one of the questions is from the CBS News poll, which was March 15th through the 18th. Looking back is the question, do you think the United States did the right thing in taking military action against Iraq, or should the U.S. have stayed out? 59% of Americans said we should have stayed out of Iraq in the first place. 36% said it's the right thing. And when the question was asked, how would you say things are going for the U.S. in its effort to bring stability and order to Iraq? Would you say things are going very well, somewhat well, somewhat badly, or very badly? Very well, 4%, somewhat well, 39%. Somewhat badly, 30%, and very badly, 24%. So 54% of the American people say that the war is going somewhere between somewhat badly and very badly. Opinion on the surge. Let's take a look from that CBS News poll. It says, as you may know, the U.S. has sent a troop surge to Iraq, from what you've heard. Would you say the troop surge is making the situation in Iraq better? Is it making it worse, or is it having no impact on the situation in Iraq? 42% of the American people said it's making the situation better. But again, a majority either was unsure or no impact at all, 34%. Worse, the surge is making things worse, 13%, 11% were understandably unsure. Now, here's an interesting piece of information. When Americans were asked, do you think, now listen to this, do you think Saddam Hussein was personally involved in the September 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon? Do you think Saddam Hussein was personally involved in the September 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon? 28% of Americans says yes, Saddam Hussein was personally involved in the 9/11 attacks. Of course, demonstrably untrue, but 28% of Americans, a little bit more than one in four people, believe that Saddam Hussein was personally involved in the 9/11 attacks. No evidence, of course, that that's in any way the case. It's not true. 58% of Americans say no, he was not involved. 14%, interestingly enough, say they were unsure. From an ABC News Washington poll, all in all, considering the costs to the United States versus the benefits to the United States, do you think the war with Iraq was worth fighting or not? 63% of Americans say the war was not worth fighting. 34% say it was worth it, and 2% unsure. So the public opinion in various polls, and then there's the Wall Street Journal, New York Times poll saying about the same thing. 60-some% of Americans say that they don't think the war was worth fighting, or we shouldn't have fought it in the first place. Interesting exchange if you saw ABC News the other night with Martha Raddatz, who is their White House correspondent now. She was interviewing Vice President Cheney in the piano lounge of the Shangri-La Resort, as a matter of fact, and spa in Oman. And here's a transcript from the Washington Post. Martha Raddatz asked the vice president, she said, two-thirds of Americans say it's not worth fighting the war in Iraq, and they're looking at the value versus the cost in American lives, certainly, and Iraqi lives. Vice President Cheney says, so? Martha Raddatz says, so you don't care what the American people think? Vice President Cheney, no. I think you cannot be blown off course by the fluctuations in the public opinion polls. Think about what would have happened if Abraham Lincoln had paid attention to polls, if they had had polls during the Civil War. He never would have succeeded if he hadn't had a clear objective, a vision of where he wanted to go, and he was willing to withstand the slings and arrows of the political wars in order to get there. So Vice President Cheney being very frank, and of course that's probably his frankness may account for his generally public opinion ratings in the 20s, but he says no, he's not interested in what the American people are thinking at this point. He says you can't base your policy on polls, and there's a certain point to that, right? You can't entirely base your policy and on polls. Well, we're at 614-292-8513. How are you feeling about the Iraq war today? Do you think that it was worth fighting? Do you think it was the thing to do? Well, Senator Barack Obama, you know, a big speech answering charges in terms of his pastor, Reverend Jeremiah Wright, at his church, Trinity Church in Chicago. And very interesting, he condemned, and he says, in fact, quoting from the speech, I've already condemned in unequivocal terms the statements of Reverend Wright that have caused such controversy. And he says, the remarks were not only wrong, and quoting again from the transcript of the speech, not only wrong, but divisive at a time when we need unity. These comments were racially charged at a time when we need to come together to solve a set of monumental problems. Two wars, a terrorist threat, a failing economy, a chronic health care crisis, and potentially devastating climate change. He says, problems that are neither black or white or Latino or Asian, but rather problems that confront us all. Interestingly enough, he did what ABC News and George Stephanopoulos and ABC News and also the New York Times, that we said it was a political act of courage. He didn't cut the Reverend Wright loose. He says, quoting again from Barack Obama's speech, as imperfect as he, Reverend Wright, may be, he has been like family to me. He strengthened my faith, officiated at my wedding, baptized my children. Not once in my conversations with him have I heard him talk about any ethnic group in derogatory terms or treat whites with whom he interacted with anything but courtesy and respect. He contains within him the contradictions, the good and the bad of the community he has served so diligently for so many years. And Barack Obama, very interesting speech, which has been generally well-received, although not well-received by everybody. And it's available on YouTube. It's about a 40-minute speech to look at. And at the same time, it is not only available on YouTube, but you can read the Dispatch has got the text, and the New York Times has got the text. And he's pretty frank about race in this country, and that's opening a good discussion. Barack Obama says segregated schools were and are inferior schools. We still haven't fixed them 50 years after Brown versus Board of Education. And the inferior education they provided then and now helps explain the pervasive achievement gap between today's black and white students. Barack Obama goes on to say, legalized discrimination where blacks were prevented, often through violence, from owning property, or loans were not granted to African-American business owners, or black homeowners could not access FHA mortgages, or blacks were excluded from unions or the police force or fire departments. That meant that black families could not amass any meaningful wealth to bequeath to future generations. That history helps explain the wealth and income gap between black and white and the concentrated pockets of poverty that persist in so many of today's rural and urban communities. He talks about the anger. I think his speech is worth talking about at length a bit, because it is so perceptive, and he's not dodging any issues here. He talks about the anger in the black community. But he also goes on to say, and again I quote, in fact, a similar anger exists within segments of the white community. Most working and middle-class white Americans don't feel that they've been particularly privileged by their race. Their experience is the immigrant experience. As far as they're concerned, no one's handed them anything. They built it from scratch. They've worked all their lives, many times only to see their jobs shipped overseas or their pension dumped after a lifetime of labor. Now, here again, Barack Obama's talking about the white community. And I'll quote again. He goes on to say, they're anxious about their futures and feel their dreams slipping away. In an era of stagnant wages and global competition, opportunity seems to be seen as a zero-sum game in which your dreams come at my expense. So when they're told to bus their children to a school across town, when they hear that an African-American is getting an advantage in landing a good job or a spot in a good college because of an injustice that they themselves never committed, when they're told that their fears about crime in urban neighborhood are somehow prejudiced, resentment builds over time. So very, very, very interesting. But he says we don't want to let these angers and statements distract us from working on the problems that we all need to work on. He finally concludes. He says that we can talk about Reverend Wright's statements from now till the end of the campaign. But he says, look, what we really need to be talking about are the issues that confront our country now. He says, and again, I quote him, we can play Reverend Wright's sermons on every channel every day and talk about them from now until the election. But we can pounce on a gaffe by a Hillary supporter. But if we do, I can tell you that in the next election, we'll be talking about some other distraction. And then another one, and then another one, and nothing will change. He says, that's one option. Or at this moment, in this election, Barack Obama says we can come together and say, not this time. This time we want to talk about crumbling schools that are stealing the future of black children and white children and Asian children and Hispanic children and Native American children. This time we want to reject this time, he says, the cynicism that tells us that these kids can't learn, that those kids who don't look like us are somebody else's problem. Children of America are not those kids. They're our kids, and we will not let them fall behind in a 21st century economy. And he goes on to say about some of the issues, other issues we want to talk about, the lines in the emergency room, the shuttered mills that once provided a decent life for men and women, et cetera, et cetera. It's really a fine speech. Whether or not you support Barack Obama, it's really a fine speech. And begins a conversation about race that I would say that we ought to have, and talks about a unity between black Americans and white Americans that's been missing for some time. Well, worth watching on YouTube or worth reading the transcript, 614-292-8513, all kinds of things to talk about today. Let's see what's on your mind. Let's go to Pete. Hello, Pete. You're on the air.
Good morning, Fred, and I enjoy your show a lot.
Thank you.
Just wanted to quote a Bible verse, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
It refers to the high price of fuel. It's in the prophet Habakkuk. That's H-A-B-A-K-K-U-K, a strange name, but this is an ancient Jewish prophet. And he says, doesn't this come from God that all the people are working just to fill their fuel tanks and the nations are tiring themselves out for nothing?
He says fuel tanks, this ancient Jewish prophet?
Well, fuel for the fire or fuel for the fire,
okay.
You know. Maybe I'm stretching it, but
I think right.
Quite interesting that he would, you know. Now, were these clever men or did he really have prophecy? We don't know. But I would just give that to your listeners. Check that second chapter of Habakkuk. It's very fascinating. And he also speaks about getting in debt, you know, that getting debt, you know, and that's kind of interesting.
Well, Pete, what do you think about the current day economic situation?
Well, I worry about it because I feel we're vulnerable and we've been put in a position, you know, all these derivatives, the banks are extending all these loans to people who couldn't afford a doghouse. They're having 8-bedroom homes there, and they couldn't afford to keep up the payments when the variable rate mortgages changed. So now the government's stepping in to bail them out. You know, I mean, that can't go on forever either. I think we're sort of on tenderhooks here. At this present time. But I have faith in America. The great engine, a big engine, and the big locomotive. We may not be number one locomotive, but we're part of the world, and I don't have any fear about our future at all whatsoever. I think what Roosevelt said is so true. All we have to fear is fear itself.
It's a good line. Yeah, it's so true. Pete, thanks so much for your call.
Thank you, sir. Bye.
Sure. The question is, who's to blame in this current bailout situation? As we all know, Bear Stearns bailed out. Everybody's worried about other mortgage lenders and other financial institutions. The conservative columnist David Brooks for the New York Times the other day asked, who is to blame? And he says, who's not to blame? The mortgage brokers were out of control. Regulators were asleep, he says. Home buyers thought they were entitled to Corian counters and two-story great rooms. Everybody from Norwegian town elders to financial geniuses decided that housing prices would always go up. He says this is an episode of mass idiocy. So he's blaming the mortgage brokers and lenders, the regulators who were asleep, and the home buyers themselves. He says there's plenty of blame to go around. Okay, let's take a look at what you have to say in our open forum. Our next caller is Bob. Hello, Bob. You're on the air.
Yeah, I computed some figures, and I don't have the exact ones in front of me about the Iraqi war.
Mm-hmm.
There's approximately 300 million people in the United States. There's approximately 78 million people in Iraq, and if we've spent $500 billion, that comes to almost $2,000 for every man, woman, and child in the United States, and equates to about $18,000 for every man, woman, and child in Iraq, including the bad guys.
Well, the question becomes, was it worth it?
No.
tell me why. Tell me why, Bob. Why do you think it was worth it?
Well, spending $18,000, you know, that's what? Almost $80,000 for every family of four in Iraq, and costing $8,000 for every family of four in the United States. I'm a family of four, and I can put a lot better place to put my $8,000.
What do you think we should have done? Should we have invaded Iraq, I guess, is the question.
No.
What about those? The president, of course, says it was the right thing to do to depose Saddam Hussein through an invasion. He says it has eliminated a real danger in the world.
Well, I'm of that opinion that I think that what has got the people over there irate to begin with was that we had military presence there, and we've only escalated the military presence there, so that's like to make people more mad.
Mm-hmm. What should we do now, Bob, in your opinion?
You know, I hate the idea of just leaving, you know, there's the you broke it, so you got to fix it kind of a thing. but I think we're just in way over our heads. I don't have any good solution, and I don't think there is any good solution.
So we hear people say, let us have an orderly withdrawal and have it soon. Let it begin within 60 days, I think Senator Clinton says. Other people say, no, we can't put a timetable on it. We have an obligation to the people of Iraq. Any ideas? It's a tough one, isn't it?
Yeah, we've got to get out, but there's no easy solution on how to do it because we sure messed things up over there.
Yeah. Okay, Bob, thanks very much. Thanks for your call. Bob says that we messed things up over there. He says the Iraq War should not have been fought, and he says it's hard to know what to do now. What's your opinion today? Should we have invaded Iraq? Should we have fought that war to depose Saddam Hussein? 614-292-8513. Maybe you would like to suggest, as President Bush does, that the war was, in fact, worth it, that it was the right thing to do. Drew is next. Hi, Drew. You're on the air.
Hey, guys. How's it going today?
Good.
You know, I want to talk a little bit about the Jeremiah Wright issue.
Yeah.
And in no way would I say, well, no, in no way is what he said defensible or excusable. But I think it goes a long way for us to understand where comments like that come from. And my father grew up in the South during the Civil Rights era. And to be perfectly honest with you, he didn't like white people for a really long time. And I remember once when I had just gotten into high school, I started making white friends. And I just asked him, I said, why don't you like white people? And he said, Drew, if every time you saw a dog, it bit you, you might not like dogs very much.
Hmm.
And I said, that's probably true. And to his credit, as he got a little older and, you know, well, I guess he was already pretty old, but as he got wiser, he made a concerted effort to have white people over for dinner. And then he, before he passed, he had great friends that were white. But it speaks to the mindset. And it's not defensible and it's not excusable, but I think it's important we understand where that type of anger and hostility that Barack Obama was talking about comes from.
Yeah, I think Barack Obama, when you read the full context of the speech, it says pretty much the same thing. He says, when you look at that generation and what they suffered, you know, he said, you can understand why there's a great deal of anger. He says, but we do have to move beyond that.
And that's the key. That's the difference with what I would like to think of my father and Jeremiah Wright, is that he didn't move beyond it. He still... I used to put it quite simply, he didn't change with the times. Now, I think what Barack Obama would do a great deal for himself is just come out and say, I don't have to dislike him to disagree with him. And it seems like he comes just short to me of saying things that are that plain.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's all I have for today.
Hey, Drew, thanks very much. Appreciate your comments today.
Talking
about the war in Iraq, we're talking about Barack Obama's speech. By the way, a local peace activist organization has asked City Council to make a statement, Columbus City Council, to make a statement about the war, to declare Columbus a peace city and to call for the orderly withdrawal of troops from Iraq at a near date. Is this something you think that City Council members should do? City Council's taken a look at that. More than 200 American cities have made similar statements. Is that the province of City Council? Would you like to see them make a statement like that, or do you think this is not a good idea? 614-292-8513. And David is on the line. Hi, David.
Yes, good morning. First of all, peace to the world. Just to identify myself, I'm a 50-year-old African-American male. I'm from a family of 13. My parents grew up in Alabama and Georgia. And my dad left the South in the early 50s because he did not want us growing up hating white people as he did, because he wanted us to have a better opportunity to really see the world through the proper lens.
Mm-hmm.
I thank God for my parents, because truly I'm from an era where this country was idealistic, and we really did believe that every individual in the United States made a difference. And it really came out of Eisenhower. President Eisenhower basically said, I don't care what color a child is in the United States, they must be educated. We must include everybody. So I have to give credit to Eisenhower as well. And he really was the last president, as far as I'm concerned, that really was a true president of the United States. And as we all know, he warned us about the military-industrial complex, which brings me to my next point. The United States has to accept responsibility for the atrocities that have been perpetrated in our name, meaning us as citizens of this country. We've allowed our government to do exactly what the founding fathers were afraid of. The founding fathers did not want this country to have a standing army that could be used for interest of the elites. And that's exactly what has happened. And we need to go back as a society and really start to say, what type of society do we really want? Forget about all this divisiveness about race, because it doesn't matter. It's irrelevant. When you look at who is really controlling the world, they could care less what they perpetrate on what group of people. It doesn't really matter. What we have to do as citizens of this country is to step back and say, how do we make this place better? Because this is all we have. We can't all 300 million of us can't immigrate someplace else.
David, you say we have a standing army that works in the interest of an elite. Tell me about that.
Well, the notion of having standing armies, as you know, when the kings of England had standing armies, they were able to do things that they're bidding to be imperialistic. Well, at one time in our history, we didn't have standing armies. The only time we enlisted an army was when we had a military conflict, like, for example, World War One.
Sure, but do you think, David, we should not have a standing army?
I do not think we should have an army that's around the world as an imperial power, because that is not in the interest of the United States.
Tell me, in what sense you think the United States is an imperial power?
Well, I mean, if you look at the amount of money that the United States spends on military, it's more than all of the world, the rest of the world combined. And supposedly all this is done to protect us. Well, I have a hard time seeing how we're being protected when we're going throughout the world and we're killing innocent men, women, and children. And if you look at how many wars since World War One, the majority of the casualties of war have been women and children. So how is that protecting me if my military is going around the world and killing women and children? We're actually waging war against humanity itself.
Well, David, of course, you understand that the Saddam Hussein and his sons and his family in their years of rule killed by all human rights organizations tally over 300,000 innocent people.
I'm not going to refute that, but by the same token, it's not my responsibility as a citizen of the United States to go around the world and try to correct the things that are going on within each and every country of the earth. What my responsibility is to make sure that my government does the right thing, and that's where I think we've fallen short, because before the first Iraq war, the people in Iraq, they did not believe we were going to attack. Why? Because they felt that we here as citizens of the United States of America have control over our government, and people here realized that Saddam Hussein was not someone they elected, and so they were shocked when we bombed and killed them. That war has been against the people of Iraq. It has been against the people of Iraq, and the wars that have been perpetrated throughout the history of time have been against the people. And it's always been people going out to fight because someone has riled us up into thinking that we have enemies somewhere.
David, I must move on. Thank you for your call today.
Thank you.
David believes that our standing army has been used mostly for the purposes of an elite here in America. And he says that wars, certainly including the wars, he says, that we fought to kill innocents, kill women and children. Well, it's certainly true that any warfare, the majority of victims of that war are civilian, no matter who is fighting, no matter where it is. And certainly in the 20th and 21st century, it's not a war. If it ever was a war confined to battlefields, I don't know. In any century, I'm not sure that it was. But it certainly is not with the kinds of huge weapons that are employed now through the 20th century, World War I, World War II. 50 million people killed in World War II, according to some estimates. Amazing. 50 million. Incredible. So war does kill innocents, women, children, elders, people who can't get out of the way, people who are not combatants. I mean, there's no question any war does that. We're going to pause for a little break here with some pieces of information for you, and then we'll be back. Callers, hang on the line. It's our open forum. In the second hour, Mayor Coleman joins us on WOSU 820 NPR News. Welcome back to Open Line to WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. We're right in the middle of an open forum. And at 614-292-8513, get the callers. Let's go right to you, hear what's on your mind this morning. Our first caller in the second half hour is Bob. Hello, Bob.
Yes.
Go right ahead.
Fred, I'm a little disappointed in you this morning. Usually you're fairly neutral and perceptive. And when it comes to Obama's speech, you're not neutral and not perceptive.
I'm not neutral about the speech. You're right. I think
you're
it's a wonderful
very pro.
I think it's a wonderful speech. And as I said, whether or not you support Barack Obama, and that's immaterial to me. But tell me about my not being perceptive, though. That's what I want to know.
he's a very eloquent speaker. Unfortunately, in the past, he has said, yes, I'm not experienced, etc., but judgment is a factor. And any man who could have his children going to a church where there is a preacher like that demonstrates poor judgment on Obama's part and maybe a lack of courage of not standing up and saying, this is not what I believe, and walking out. Because I assume that Obama does not believe, you know, goddamn America. I assume he doesn't mean
that. Yeah, I think he does.
I assume he's bright enough to know that AIDS was not created by the United States government to kill black men. I assume he's brilliant enough to know that.
I'm sure so.
But these things were said by his minister, and he stayed in the church. Well, that's purely poor judgment.
Well, I think that's an interesting point, Bob. Yeah, I mean, in other words, we do disagree in our churches with things that our ministers, priests, or rabbis might say. But at what point? I guess the question you're suggesting is, at a certain point, if the statements are sufficiently extreme and sufficiently wrongheaded, it may be our duty to leave a particular church.
Don't you think that those are sufficiently extreme and wrong-handed?
I think they are extreme and wrong-headed, the statements of Reverend Wright. Yes, absolutely.
Shouldn't he have said, my young girls should not hear this kind of thing?
You know, I don't know, because I don't know how often in other words, we're seeing the excerpts of the speech on YouTube, at least I am, and I presume you are too. I don't know how often those statements are made. I don't know whether Barack Obama's – I don't know how often he was in the church. I don't know how often his children were there. But certainly, if I heard statements like that from a priest or minister, I'd want to be having a conversation with him, and I would consider leaving. I don't know, indeed, how many of those his family heard. But that's an interesting point.
But one time would have been enough. I mean, he wouldn't have to make those kinds of speeches. And looking at his dress, he obviously did it different days. Because
he was dressed
outlandishly, maybe, but from my point, because I'm a 71-year-old white man, I'm not a man of color.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, different days, and he was so far out. Now, maybe not for his community, and if so, then if Barack Obama wants to say, "Well, this is my community, this is what I am,"
mm-hmm.
Okay. Quit trying to act like white people should listen to you if indeed you're going to say this is what you are. That's not what he's been saying. He's been saying we should ignore color. We should judge people by who they are, etc.
Sure.
And I can't see where a man supposing to have good judgment would have stayed in that church for 20
years.
Well, you
know, interesting point, caller. Let me, Bob, have Mike Huckabee, former Arkansas governor, weigh in on this, as he did on Fox News the other day. Let me just read a little quote from him and see whether you agree or disagree. Mike Huckabee said, quote, "You can't hold the candidate responsible for everything around him, the people around him, everything they may say or do." He says, many times, those were statements lifted out of the context of a larger sermon. Sermons, after all, are rarely written word for word by pastors like Reverend Wright, who are delivering them extemporaneously and caught up in the emotion of the moment. There are things that sometimes get said that if you put them on paper and looked at them in print, you'd say, well, I didn't mean to say it quite like that. So a minister himself, Baptist ministers, you know, Rep. Mike Huckabee says, that's his opinion anyway, but tell me what you think.
Well, Huckabee, being a Baptist minister, will cut people a lot of slack far beyond what is reasonable. Which you may say that's a good thing, or you may say it's not a good thing. But sermons are not extemporaneous things. They're things that are done over the process of a week or more. They are written. You can tell that he was looking at his writing, looking at what he had written, and usually they're written and gone over a number of times.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not a slip of the tongue type thing.
No, generally I would say you're right. Sermons are one of the highlights of, I would say, a minister's work, and they are generally thoroughly prepared. But you can depart from a text as well. Look, of course, Barack Obama does not defend any of these statements, and I certainly don't.
But he doesn't condemn them very much either. He says, well, no, they're not what I would say, but he didn't act. He has a lot of nice words, but he didn't act.
Point taken that he didn't act, but let me say this, Bobby. Let me quote from the speech. He says, I have already condemned in unequivocal terms the statement of Reverend Wright that have caused such controversy. I strongly disagree with his political views. And he goes on to completely condemn that. I urge you to read the text of the speech. And I would also urge you to go beyond the narrow issue, although important issue, of Reverend Wright and look at the whole speech. Because where I say it's a good speech, I'm thinking well beyond the statements about Reverend Wright. I'm thinking about Barack Obama's call for a national dialogue about race. That's where I think it's a wonderful speech.
He wrote, and Obama gives good speeches. He's a good speaker. That's not what I'm looking at. If we were going to elect good speaker, we can go back to Clinton, for crying out loud, and his bad behavior. But he's a good speaker and can motivate people. It's the same kind of thing. Your speeches are fine, but the actions, what you do or don't do, tells me what's really in your heart and in your mind.
Well, let me say this. Of course, actions are very, very important. But when we say Barack Obama is a good speaker, I want to say more than a good speaker. When you look at the ideas expressed, of course, he's an eloquent speaker, and the words he chooses are fine. But when you look at the ideas expressed in this speech about racial unity in America, it is the quality of his ideas that I'm responding to. Now, you do raise an interesting point. If Sunday after Sunday, and I don't know how often these speeches were made, did Barack Obama hear some of them? Yes, he did. Apparently, he says he did. Were his children exposed to them? I do not know. But I think you raise an interesting question as to whether he had a duty to leave the church. And Bob, that's your opinion, and I'm grateful you called in with it. And we'll see what everybody else has to say.
Very good.
Hey, thanks so much for your call. And we're having an open forum here. And let us go to Jack. Hello, Jack. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hello.
The fuel situation we had this week, you know, you had a program where people was talking about energy, the energy crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Last March, when the ExxonMobil guy got the $40 million bonus and, you know, and prices started going up, I went and bought myself an ethanol burning truck, an E85. I've had it for a year. I burn ethanol. I ain't bought gasoline in a whole year. And it functions fine. It's really economical. It's as cheap as unleaded gasoline.
Are you talking here, Jack, about a biodiesel? Is that what you have?
No, I'm talking about E85 ethanol.
85 ethanol, okay.
E85. You can buy it. The Kroger stores has it. Giant Eagle has it. Certified has it. Sunoco has it. About a year ago, everybody, you know, quite a few people around town started selling it. One of the problems I'd heard before was you couldn't get the product. It's 30 cents cheaper than regular. It gives you just a little less mileage. It ain't, you know, maybe a mile or two, but it ain't that much.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're interested in the environment and you want to do something for it, that's the simplest thing you can possibly do. I mean, it don't cost you any more for the vehicle, neither.
There you go.
I mean, you know, I went and bought a new Dodge here 3 months ago, 4 months ago. And, you know, I had an older vehicle that I bought to try the ethanol in. It worked, so I went and bought a new truck. And it didn't cost a dime more. And they're available. All you got to do is tell them, well, I want an E85 engine in it.
Yeah, that's right. And that's a great idea.
It just works great. And like I say, it's been a year ago this March was when I did it, and I have not bought a single gallon of gasoline.
Oh, very good. Another possibility, of course, is a hybrid vehicle, you know, which uses very, very little. Like there's a Honda Civic Hybrid, there's a Toyota Prius, there's a Ford Escape. I think Chrysler may have a hybrid vehicle now, GMC. Another way to do it. But yeah, you're helping the environment, and you're saving a little money.
Yeah, those things cost too much money.
There is a premium.
I mean, you have to pay a lot of money extra for a hybrid vehicle, but for the technology in it, you have to pay a dime more for E85. And I guarantee, if you're upset about E85, you know you're too finicky or something.
But there's about a $4,000 premium on a hybrid vehicle. That's right, $3,000 or $4,000.
Yeah,
right,
well, you get an E85 engine and a new vehicle for nothing. Don't cost you nothing any more than what it would. You know, all you have to do is tell them what you want.
Jack.
And I just feel good about it. Every time I go and get it, I just feel good.
Well, that's a good thing to feel good about. You're right to feel good about it.
Yeah.
Jack, thanks for the
That's about it. Thanks.
Thanks for the recommendation. Bye. And next is John. Hello, John.
Hi, Fred. Hello?
Yes, you're on.
Oh, good. You know you're one of my favorite people, and I listen to your show every day. But I've called up to complain about the way you handled one of your callers this morning.
Uh-huh.
I'm just sick at the demonizing of Barack Obama that's going on the basis of his church. It's based on plain false premises, which are probably willfully and maliciously entertained. He said in the speech, and repeated on Larry King Live last night, that he did not hear the inflammatory comments that have been in that looped tape. He did hear him say controversial things,
mm-hmm.
by which he meant salty language. He probably used, you know, the F word and other stuff like that, talking about marital relations.
Mm-hmm.
To go on as if he had heard damn America and all the rest of it is just viciously false. And when you say, gee, I don't know, and you said three times, that's an interesting point, I think you're pandering to this demonizing, and I want to call you on it.
I'm not pandering, John. As a matter of fact, I was not aware that Barack Obama had made the statement that he had never heard those particular inflammatory remarks.
It's in the speech you were reading to us this morning.
No, I do not see it in the text of the speech.
Well, go back and look again. Shall I dredge up the text and call you back and read it to you? I've got it on my computer. It just take too long.
Well, let's take this point that Barack Obama said he did not hear those statements.
He heard controversial things, but not the outrageous ones, and he said further that if he had heard them, he would have called the pastor on it, and if the pastor hadn't given him satisfaction, it's hard to imagine he could, because those are despicable comments, he would have left the church. He said all that. It's in the public record.
Well, I'm glad you're correcting the record here, John.
And those who demonize him are just plain going contrary to facts already on the record.
Well,
it's just making our politics into trash.
Well, first of all, I think our caller may not have known, as I did not know, that Barack Obama said that he never heard those remarks. I've read widely about this, and I did not know that, but I'm glad you correct the record. So, number two, I'm not going to impute bad motivations to our caller, because indeed he may have genuinely understood that Barack Obama might have been there for those speeches. And if he had been there for those speeches, I mean, if that was the understanding of the caller, that he'd been there. And you certify this, you say this is true yourself, he should have left, and Barack Obama himself says, I would have left. So I think the caller genuinely didn't know, because I didn't know that Barack Obama said he never heard those. So I'm not going to impute bad motivation to the caller. That having been said, I think there is a lot of trash going around about Barack Obama. I think it's promoted by talk shows and by cable networks, and Barack Obama says in the speech, we can talk about Reverend Wright's words, you know, all through the campaign and be distracted by this, or we can come to grip with some of the real racial issues in the country. And my point in reading from the speech this morning was to say this, that this is a fine speech. Let's move away from Wright and say, look, let's look about the dialogue among the races and the unity among the races that Barack Obama is suggesting that we pursue. And that's the important point to me.
Yes, and I am very grateful to you for having taken the time to read portions of the speech. And I did not call to challenge your listeners' motives, because I don't know him, and I don't know what lack of information he may or may not have. My problem is with your facilitating that by finding it interesting and by not having read the speech carefully enough to know that he has repeatedly, flatly stated he did not hear the statements in the loop, but other controversial statements, which he explained in several interviews, he was referring to salty language primarily.
Yeah,
willfully misrepresenting the record. Not your listener, because I don't know about him,
sure.
And I certainly know you well enough to know you wouldn't do that. I mean, that's that's out of question. But it really aggravates me to hear folks contributing to hostility and misunderstanding and demonizing and
I agree with you in terms of hostility and demonizing, and if we don't get beyond these narrow issues. But I think the caller was very sincere in what he was saying, and he added the same information John, I'm going to put you on hold because you won't let me get a word in edgewise. I'm going to say this. The caller had the level of information he had. I had the level of information that I had. Now, you've corrected that, and that's great. But at the same time, let me tell you this, that I think the caller was sincere in what he was saying, and not everybody has the level of information that you have, and I'm happy you've corrected the record, and I'm going to move on from there, and I thank you for your call. Dwayne is on the air. Hello, Dwayne.
Oh, hi. Fred, I think I'll first defend you and say that I didn't hear you actually doing what the last caller just said you did. So, and on the other side of the issue, has anyone tried to defend Reverend Wright? Because in the context of these speeches that he was giving, the information that he was portraying to his church, yes, he chose words that are offensive, but I think sometimes you gotta offend in order to get people to hear you. So I just want to defend him and say that sometimes the truth hurts.
Well, I think when you use some of the words that Reverend Wright used, I really can't defend them. I mean, I think that indeed they get in the way of communication, in the way of information. They don't help people understand. They set up barriers. I think I know that kind of rhetoric. I've heard that kind of rhetoric before, and I understand that it comes out of a certain kind of anger. But I think, as Barack Obama has made the point, that that's a kind of rhetoric that comes from an older generation that was hurt, you know, very in the civil rights struggle, that has a lot of anger. And Barack Obama says we got to move beyond that. I think it's not productive rhetoric. It's rhetoric that divides rather than unites. So I guess I'd have to say that I would like to see Reverend Wright and others who use that kind of rhetoric move beyond it, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I'm trying myself.
You trying?
Thanks for hearing me.
Okay, is that it, Dwayne?
Yes.
Okay, thanks for your call. I think Barack Obama makes the point that that kind of rhetoric is not helpful, that it's divisive. And we want to have a national conversation on race, and I do urge you to read the text of Barack Obama's speech. We want to have a national conversation on race that gets beyond blame and divisiveness, and that unites rather than divides. And I think that whether that conversation comes from Barack Obama, who is leading, I think, the conversation among political candidates, it could also as well, hopefully, come from Senator Clinton or Senator McCain. I mean, everybody should get in on this conversation. And hopefully we can have a productive conversation about race in the United States. We're joined by Bill. Hello, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi, Fred. I think your new system of keeping the listener on, which I say in real time on your conversations as opposed to delayed is working out a lot better. I know when you're coming.
Okay, Bill.
I called in to talk about government agencies and their public debt. Just first of all, the federal government is, we've all heard, I'm sure, $9 trillion in debt and growing. And we're paying about $450 billion a year in interest, which is more than we're spending on the Iraq War. About 27% of your income tax you're paying this year is going to be going to interest on that debt. 27%. Pretty impressive.
Pretty incredible.
By the way,
huh?
Bush and the Congress have got it growing at about $500 billion a year. So every 2 years, we're going to hit another trillion if they keep going.
What's the answer, Bill? What's the solution?
Well, go to the I think I'll just switch to cry. That's about the only answer we've come
You're
up with.
You're
going to
cry?
Maybe on this national dialogue on race, we could squeeze in a little national dialogue on too much debt.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Many conservatives, as well as those who are not conservative, are concerned about the spending habits of the Republican Congress. They've been very critical. They've got to be brought in. And, of course, well, what about the tax? Bush's tax reductions that Senator McCain says he first opposed but now says should be extended. What's your position on that?
Well, we simply are going way over our head to pull this thing down to $500 billion less per year being spent. Of course, means stopping the empire building, changing the tax structure a little bit, cutting down on some of the government spending, and some of these idiotic laws. Like we're fighting a war on drugs, I believe. We're fighting a war on terrorism. Just slow down and be more rational about the whole thing would be one absolutely essential feature. I was going to switch down the city of Columbus, get a little closer to home as long as I'm talking about debt.
Mm-hmm, okay.
Two and about a quarter billion, this is not million, or certainly not trillion, billion dollars in debt now, in bonds, and that's, if you multiply that by 5%, it's about $100 million per year the city of Columbus is spending on interest, and they're thinking about raising, I think, the income tax a little bit in order to help pay for all these things they need, as opposed to paying down their debt. Now the city, the school district of Columbus is building new buildings and has had a bond levy to help do that. And they needed about $400 million of local funds to match some state funds, which I'm not sure where they're coming from, whether they're coming from borrowing or not, but I think it's a line item. So that's not quite so bad, that part of it. But the point is, in order to get the $400 billion, they had float bonds, and that incurred a $300 million interest cost over the 25 years or so that we'll be paying off those bonds. Now the school district's thinking again about going into debt financing to get some more buildings, as opposed to building them much slower but with current money. So if we wonder why we're having a bit of a financial crisis, I think it's because we got too much debt out there, both personal and public. And that's my thought for the day. Be glad to respond to your insight.
Well, thanks very much for your call. Appreciate your call. Our next caller here is Helen. Hello, Helen. You're on the air.
Hello. I'm calling to talk about the war.
Yeah.
And I feel that it was a grave mistake. I think that Saddam Hussein deserved to be toppled, but it needed to come from the people. And I feel that we weakened the people with our sanctions over the years. That you can't force democracy on anyone. It needs to come from the people. And
Helen, can I ask you a question about that?
Sure.
Is there any way that given that the Iraqi people did not have arms, had no way to proceed against a heavily armed government, was there any way that toppling Saddam Hussein could have come from the people?
Well, it couldn't, because we had weakened them over so many years. Their health, their morale, everything about that. Without strength of security and it was difficult, but certainly we made it worse by weakening them as a people. I think that we need to get out, and that money should be set aside in some type of fund for Iraq to rebuild itself. I went to school with a lot of Iraqi engineers, and I think it's awful that in our rebuilding attempts, which have been unsuccessful, they didn't involve the Iraqis, but rather our own corporate people. My other point,
Helen, let me ask you this about getting. You say you think we need to get out. What's a responsible way of doing that? I mean, should we get out expeditiously? Should we wait until the Iraqi government tells us that indeed their troops and police are sufficiently trained to provide security? How do you decide how to do that?
Well, like other people have said, I don't think there's any good way, but delaying it isn't going to make it better. I think we need to get out and let them know that. And what really bothers me is when we hear people say Iraq's got to step up and do their job, and they never asked for it in the first place. They didn't ask for the job. So I think it's even when I hear people I respect say that, it surprises me.
So you would set a timetable for a near departure?
Yes.
Okay.
And set up a fund to hopefully it's global, but to supply money for rebuilding when they're ready, not to rebuild things that are going to be torn down again. Civil war is violent. Civil war is horrible, but they've got to fight it themselves if that's what they decide to do. I mean, we've put them in the position of needing to do something, and we need to let them do it, as awful as it will be, as violent and as deathly as it will be. I also, the other comment I wanted to make was when I've heard on your program people say that it's okay for a politician not to be specific because it means that they're more open, and I really appreciate that comment because I think that we need a president who's very open-minded and not grounded in specifics.
Helen, thanks for your call, and our next caller here is Raymond. Hello, Raymond.
Hi there, Brad. I just had... I've been listening, and I'm calling about the war, but I really want to make one little short comment about Obama.
Mm-hmm.
I think I have not heard all of Obama's speech. I've heard excerpts from it, but I think one thing that he's addressing that if you really look at the situation is that we do still have prejudice alive in our country in specific areas of our population.
Mm-hmm. Sure, we do, mm-hmm.
And that's what he's trying to address. And you know, unfortunately, I'm not sure that he can solve that problem. I know that if you look at the breakdown of the Ohio vote, at least, you'll see that he won the metropolitan areas pretty handily, but in the rural areas, he didn't do very well, which I think the Dispatch wrote an editorial on that, which I think was pretty good.
Well, I wouldn't assume, Raymond, just that Barack Obama, because he didn't do well in rural areas, that I wouldn't assume that
I don't think that you can make that bold assumption, but I do know, having lived in those areas at one time, that there is a lot more racial bias in those areas than in the metropolitan areas where you associate with blacks on a fairly regular basis.
Well, I think, there's nothing like it in terms of surmounting racial prejudice. There's nothing like human person-to-person contact,
that's
getting
right.
to know somebody and getting right. to know their family
yeah.
and living in the same neighborhood. It really, really helps. And also I want to say that Barack Obama, what he's saying in the speech is, let's get beyond these divisions. Let's begin understanding that white people and black people and Latino people and Asian people and the multicolored U.S. spectrum, that we all have these interests in common, that we have an interest in trying to figure out how to end the Iraq war
and
honorably,
right
that we
on.
Have an interest in getting health care to everybody, you know, that we have an interest
in getting educated. Bringing all the different factions together, I think he's right on it. I just hope he's successful in doing that.
And again, I think whether you support Obama or whether you don't is immaterial. I think these are worthy remarks. Yeah.
Well, he does bring hope to our country in a time when we need that. And I think that, you know, no matter who you're voting for, at least you'll have the feeling that, you know, maybe there is some hope that we can change some things.
Yeah. Okay, that about it?
No, I want to talk. The war is really what I called about.
Okay.
I think that we did make a mistake going in. I think we miscalculated the cost and the overall cost of the war. And I remember, didn't you have somebody on here recently about the $3 trillion war?
Yes, yeah.
Like
economist
that.
Joseph Stiglitz says that we're going to spend about $3 trillion, according to his calculation.
That was amazing to me. I never stopped to even take that into consideration. But that's just, and I think she say that if you stacked $1,000 bills, the cost of that war would be like 63 miles high or something like that.
Yeah, if it were in trillions, that's exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah, but I think that. You know, we made a mistake going in. We thought it was going to be an easy war, and we didn't really even get what we wanted to go in, that we went in for. But I think that what we need to do is set a date, withdrawal date, and give them a chance to pull the segments together, and then leave a force large enough to protect the oil supply, so that, you know, we continue to get our oil out of there.
Okay. Raymond, appreciate your calling.
You bet.
We have time for one more caller here, and that caller is Bill. Hello, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi, Fred. How are you?
Good. We've got 2 minutes, but I wanted to get you on here.
Okay. Well, really, really briefly, it really sounds like you're bending over backwards to accept what Obama has to say here, and in great part because if we're talking about not going to divisiveness, it's important for Barack Obama to stand up against black racism.
And I think he has in the speech, if you read the speech.
He didn't do it until the spotlight was on it, and then he did it three-quarters of the way. He has to lead the way. And in leading the way, that means to reject when it comes in front of him. I can't imagine that Dr. Martin Luther King would have sat through that kind of sermon from his own pastor. And then just
Raymond, may I say two things? A previous caller made the point that Barack Obama said he never heard those sermons. He was not in church for those sermons. Secondly, if you read the speech, I really encourage you to do that. He thoroughly rejects those comments. He condemns them and rejects them in every possible way. I mean, what more could he say?
He could have done something at the time, and he's the senator. He knows what's going on in his church. He knows what's coming out of that pastor. This is the man that he based the premise of his book on. I will vote for Barack Obama in November if he's the candidate, but I'm so seriously disappointed at how this falls so many steps short, and folks like yourself are so willing to fall into a trap of, oh, this is wonderful, when it's really just part of the way there.
Well, we just have 30 seconds. Number one, I just want to say that as I read the Obama speech, and we disagree in how we read it, he has unequivocally condemned and rejected those comments by the Reverend Wright, as he should. And call back another time. We'll continue the conversation. We got to go. Thanks for your call. The news is next. Then Mayor Coleman joins us at listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR. PR News.